Philistines encamped at Aphek. The Philistines drew up in line against Israel. And when the battle spread, Israel was defeated before the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the field of battle. I just pause to note, I don't have a map for us to look at, but we're about 25 miles inside Israelite territory where this battle happens. So the Philistines are definitely expanding their control of the region. We're deep within Israelite territory where these things happen. And when the people came to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that he may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." A couple notes there. Who do they say defeated them? The Lord. I mean, obviously it was the Philistines holding the swords, right? But that's not how they view it. And there's a little note here. "Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord here from Shiloh, that," third person singular, "may come among us and save us from the power of our enemies." Are they hoping that Yahweh will save them? Or are they actually imagining that the Ark will save them? Hebrew doesn't have a neuter. It does have gendered pronouns. So we can distinguish between he and she. But the Ark is a masculine noun. So it's not altogether clear whether they're hoping the Ark will save them or whether Yahweh will save them. You would think that that's not necessarily a big distinction, especially based on what they do, but it's an interesting thing to note. Verse 4, "So the people sent to Shiloh and brought from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who is enthroned on the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. As soon as the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel gave a mighty shout, so that the earth resounded. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shouting, they said, 'What does this great shouting in the camp of the Hebrews mean?' And when they learned that the Ark of the Lord had come to the camp, the Philistines were afraid, for they said, 'A god has come into the camp.' And they said, 'Woe to us, for nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us! Who can deliver us from the power of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with every sort of plague in the wilderness. Take courage and be men, O Philistines, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. Be men and fight.' So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and they fled every man to his home, and there was a very great slaughter. For 30,000 foot soldiers of Israel fell, and the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. A man of Benjamin ran from the battle line and came to Shiloh the same day, with his clothes torn and with dirt on his head. When he arrived, Eli was sitting on his seat by the road, watching, for his heart trembled for the Ark of God. And when the man came into the city and told the news, all the city cried out. Then Eli heard the sound of the outcry, and he said, 'What is this uproar?' Then the man hurried and came and told Eli. Now Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were set so that he could not see. And the man said to Eli, 'I am he who has come from the battle. I fled from the battle today.' And he said, 'How did it go, my son?' He who brought the news answered and said, 'Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has also been a great defeat among the people. Your two sons also, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured.' As soon as he mentioned the Ark of God, Eli fell over backward from his seat by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died, for the man was old and heavy. He had judged Israel 40 years. Now his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant, about to give birth. And when she heard the news that the Ark of God was captured, and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed and gave birth, for her pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the women attending her said to her, 'Do not be afraid, for you have borne a son.' But she did not answer or pay attention. And she named the child Ichabod, saying, 'The glory has departed from Israel, because the Ark of God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband.' And she said, 'The glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured.'" What strikes you about that chapter? So much going on. Yeah, so for the dying wife who's just born a child, as well as for Eli as he's listening to the messenger, right? The ark is the central concern amidst all of this tragedy. It's the loss of the ark that is the most troubling news. Why would that be? The ark, what is it about the ark? What's the shape of the ark? What's it like? Where does it live? What happens in relation to it? He sits enthroned above the cherubim, right? That's the cherubim who are on the lid of the ark, right? I can't draw a cherubim, so there's our ark, right? There's cherubim. I told you I can't draw a cherubim, right? And so, need a yellow marker or something, right? Or maybe I just won't, right? God's presence is supposed to be located above the cherubim on the ark. So that's the mercy seat. That's where the priest goes to place the blood for the Day of Atonement, right? This is the visible symbol of God's presence, although it's not supposed to be visible, right? It's supposed to be within the Holy of Holies in the tabernacle, shielded from view for the safety of God's people. But that ark is like the locus, or the symbolic locus of God's presence with his people. Why do they take it with them into battle? It's happened before. So, right? It happens in the what are sometimes called the Yahweh Wars, right? The wars that God declared against groups along the way as they're coming through the wilderness and as they enter into the Promised Land with Joshua. This would not be the first time the ark has gone to war. And God has promised his presence with them, yeah. So what's difference about this war? Okay, yes. So God allows the ark to be captured. Although when we get into chapter 5, that won't go the way the Philistines expected to. Or the way the Israelites expected it to, interestingly enough. But what's different about earlier wars where the ark was present? Yeah, that seems too easy for it to be the answer, right? But those are wars that the Lord commanded, right? And so bringing the ark is essentially Yahweh leading his people into war, right? Is this a war that the Lord commanded? We have no indication that it was, right? Now, obviously, they have to respond to a Philistine incursion into their land, right? But what else is missing from the chapter? Think about Joshua. It may have been a while since you've read Joshua, right? But when they're defeated at Ai, what do? Right? Jericho was a success, and so they march against Ai, and they lose. And what's their response? Well, they pray. Right? Joshua falls on his knees and asks, you know, why has the Lord abandoned his people, right? And it's because of sin. And they draw lots and they come by house and then, sorry, by tribe and then by clan and then by household. And Achan is singled out, and the sin is dealt with, right? Things are atoned for, and then they're able to go and defeat Ai. But what's their response here? where they lose to the Philistines. They recognize that it's Yahweh's doing, right? Why has Yahweh done this? Verse 3, why has Yahweh defeated us today before the Philistines? But what's the next thing they say? Right? It's not, let's enter into a season of repentance and soul searching and find out why this thing has happened. It's, let's bring the ark. Right? Because the ark, as the visible symbol of God's presence, right? That means God's reputation is on the line. Right? We don't normally think about it this way with modern warfare, but in the ancient world, war between nations was seen as a contest between the gods, right? And the reason my team wins is because my God is better than your God. Well, if the Lord is letting this happen to us, then if we bring the ark, then he's more invested in what happens, right? And so he's not going to let us lose. So they're using the rites and the ceremonies, right? They're using things to manipulate God's behavior and to get him to do what they want. Jody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. God.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we don't. They have and they haven't in a weird way, right? God has become someone they can put in a box, right? And they can shake the box. They can tape the box closed. They can open it up when they want to. They can use the box when it conveniences them. And although we don't get, we don't know, like, did they check with Eli? Hey, Eli, is this a good idea? Or did maybe Eli say, hey, why don't you do this? But what we do get, right, Hophni and Phinehas are there with the ark. It tells us that expressly in verse 4. And then we get this haunting note near the end of the chapter, that he had judged Israel for 40 years. Think about that for a moment. We've reflected on these early chapters, and at the beginning, there's this contrast, right, between unfaithful Eli and his sons and faithful Hannah, right, and faithful Samuel and faithful Elkanah and this, and the people who are complaining about the behavior of the priests. And there seems to be this disconnect. But here in this chapter, I think we see in the people's understanding, right, in their grasp of catechism, so to speak, the results of 40 years of Eli's ministry among the people, that they would even consider this kind of rabbit foot theology as a good idea.
My image of it is that there's some anxiety, and so his heart trembles for the ark of the Lord. But this doesn't sound like a constant sense of the ark, knowing God's going to deliver us.
Yeah, Eli knows, right? He's got the news, and he's resigned to what's going to happen to his sons. He's been told they're going to die on the same day, and here we get a sense that maybe this wasn't Eli's idea, right? Because he's worried, and he knows that they're out there in a war, the two of them together, in a great place to be killed on the same day, right? And if they're the priests there with the ark, what's that mean for the ark?
Or he could have just yielded. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's still, his reaction is still, we talked last week about him not really dealing with the reality of the situation and his own behavior, and that kind of continues.
Think about that picture in light of the line that he had judged Israel 40 years. Is that what it looked like for those 40 years for him to judge Israel? He's 98 when this happens. That means he was 58 when he started judging Israel. That means there was probably a pattern already set in the way he related to his sons. Is this what it's looked like for most of his time judging Israel, for him to sit on a throne away from the action and worry over what's happening? Yeah. He's 98, but turn with me, if you would, to Deuteronomy 34. Yeah. If you look with me at Deuteronomy 34 and verse 7. It's the last chapter in Deuteronomy. It narrates Moses' death. It's a battle. Oh, never mind. No, I'm not going to go there. Verse 7, it says, Moses was 120 years old when he died. His eye was undimmed and his vigor unabated. Now, Eli is no Moses. And we know that. Right? Moses has 22 more years on him, right? But his eye is undimmed and his vigor unabated. And the description of Eli is not just a picture of where he is in the midst of the action and what he's doing, but his eye is rather more than dimmed, right? And the eye for the Old Testament is generally an indicator of overall health. So when it talks about eyes being dimmed, not just in narrative, but also in the Psalms, that's not just a comment on someone's vision. That's usually a comment on their general health. Their seeing is connected. So when it says his eyes are set so that he cannot see, right? It's not just about why he has to have people tell him. We've been told already in earlier chapters that his eyes were dim, especially in chapter 3 when the Lord calls Samuel. Yes. Yeah, yeah. Like he's starting to feel like maybe he's reached middle age at 120.
The comment about his vigor not being free, is there a programmatic statement there? It's kind of like you'll see a lot of that, like Joshua Chamberlain in the Civil War. He dies at 80 something, and some say he died at his wounds. I mean, that was just the thing they put on there. Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering if part of that is indicating that just the character of Moses as well as his physical.
I reckon so, yeah. Yeah, it's not just a comment about his physical wholeness, but his character and his mind. So. But remember, as we leave the Pentateuch, right, that chapter that we just dipped into on the death of Moses, it sets us to looking for one like Moses. One of the last lines in Deuteronomy 34 is, no prophet has arisen like him since. So we're looking for a new Moses. And Eli, in this description, is perhaps in some ways deliberately contrasted with that picture of Moses at the end of Moses' ministry, which couples with the chapter before, right? Where Samuel is attested or confirmed to the whole nation as a prophet for whom the Lord would let not even a single one of his words fall to the ground. And this chapter is a fulfillment of the word of the Lord through Samuel, right? The death of Samuel's sons and the survivor of one member of Eli's house, right? Ichabod, left to grow up without parents because of the wickedness of Eli's house. So, what else do you notice in the chapter? Think about the Philistines for a moment. You would think, having come from Judges, there'd be a little bit more there. That what would follow this would be a period of oppression and then of repentance and then the raising up of a new judge. That doesn't happen to be what follows this chapter, although it may be why, you know, once we're finished dealing with the arc narrative, so to speak, one of the very next things is the people asking for a king in chapter 8. But we'll get there. But what about the Philistines themselves? What do you notice, Josiah? They're terrified. They have some inkling of what's going on. They clearly haven't taken Bible classes at the local theological college, right? They're missing some details. But there's a sense in which they get it, in ways that the Israelites don't. There are divine beings now in the camp of their enemy, and they're terrified, and they take it seriously. Israel both takes it seriously and doesn't. Right? They want the ark for the sake of winning, but they handle that in a way that seems to lack any kind of reverence or self-awareness. Well, the Philistines are terrified. Yeah, they know what this means. And they don't know the fullness of what this means, right? But they know well enough to know that this means they're in trouble. They know well enough to connect the gods, and they're thinking of it in polytheistic terms, right? But they know well enough to connect the gods who are in the camp over there with the gods who set these plagues on the Egyptians. So they know something of the Exodus. A memory that seems to matter more to the Philistines at this moment than it does to the Israelites. Right? In the midst of that, the best they can do is say, okay, well, we're not going to surrender, right? We're probably going to die, but that would be better than being slaves, right? And so they strap on their boots and they sharpen their swords and they go out fearing for their lives, but winning the day. Winning the day. There's also that passing comment, as they say to each other, implies that this is in the midst of a period of oppression, which might explain why we're right, like 25 miles inside Israel at this point. That comment that, lest you become slaves to the Hebrews as they have been to you. There in verse 9. So we get the sense that maybe this has been going on a little bit longer, which makes it all the more striking that Yahweh is not more involved than just, hey, let's go get the ark. Then we have to win.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yeah, the line here from the Philistine commander definitely echoes what is said to Joshua. What's said to Joshua so many times in Joshua chapter 1 that you start to wonder if he struggled with those things.
Right.
Mm-hmm. We've got a little bit of time left. Let's take a sneak peek at chapter 5. And I think what we'll find is that the Israelites weren't wrong in that the ark can defeat the Philistines. But they were wrong in thinking that having the ark meant the Israelites would beat the Philistines. We'll see that they actually go, the ark goes on its own campaign against the Philistines, defeating each of their five cities, and without the help of the Israelite army. So let's read over chapter 5 and then just leave us with some things to ponder for next week. When the Philistines captured the Ark of God, they brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. Then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it into the house of Dagon and set it up beside Dagon. And when the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and put him back in his place. But when they rose early on the next morning, behold, Dagon had fallen face downward on the ground before the ark of the Lord, and the head of Dagon and both his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk of Dagon was left to him. This is why the priests of Dagon and all who enter the house of Dagon do not tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. The hand of the Lord was heavy against the people of Ashdod, and he terrified and afflicted them with tumors, both Ashdod and its territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how things were, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is hard against us and against Dagon, our God." So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" They answered, "Let the ark of the God of Israel be brought around to Gath." I guess the Philistine leaders from Gath weren't there. So they brought the ark of the God of Israel there. But after they had brought it around, the hand of the Lord was against the city, causing a very great panic. And he afflicted the men of the city, both young and old, so that tumors broke out on them. So they sent the ark of God to Ekron. But as soon as the ark of God came to Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, "They have brought around to us the ark of the God of Israel to kill us and our people." They sent therefore and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines and said, "Send away the ark of the God of Israel and let it return to its own place so that it may not kill us and our people." For there was a deathly panic throughout the whole city. The hand of God was very heavy there. The men who did not die were struck with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. If you have a map in the back of your Bible, there were five cities that belonged to the Philistines: Ashdod, Ekron, Gath, Ashkelon, and I think Gaza. Not sure, actually, on the fifth city. But these are the five cities of the Philistines. The five lords of the Philistines are the commanders of those cities. And here in this chapter, right, Ashkelon, Ekron, and Gath, three of them have been routed by the ark, all on its own, with the help of no army. The Lord has gone on this military campaign against the Philistines, killed untold numbers, and subdued their fighting men with tumors. We'll find out if we keep reading, we get into chapter 5, that it's even worse than that. Yeah, Gaza. Yeah, in fact, they name the cities there in chapter 5, Ashdod, Gaza, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron. Mice have also been involved. So let's look at 5 and 6 together next week. But if, as you read those over the course of the week, think about what we've read so far. Think about how it connects and how it doesn't. And notice the absence of Israelite characters in these chapters. The focus is on the Lord and his ark and what he does without the help of priest or army. So we've got a couple minutes left if we have any questions. Scott?
Yeah, I can relate to it.
Mm-hmm.
What, at the beginning of the chapter?
Chapter 4?
Yes.
Yep.
It says, and the word of Samuel came to all Israel. What,
yes. Good. So back at the beginning of chapter 4, the word of Samuel came to all Israel. So properly speaking, this may belong with chapter 3, right? And it's like a summary statement of Samuel's role as a prophet. But it sounds this ominous note over chapter 4, because if you think about the first message the Lord gives to Samuel, right, it concerns the destruction of Eli's house. So it's the last mention of Samuel we'll get for a while. You know, we'll get all the way to chapter 7 before Samuel's mentioned again. But what happens in between, especially here in chapter 4, is a prime example of the word of the Lord through Samuel actually being played out and confirmed. So it sounds that ominous note, and it also kind of pauses Samuel's story for a while. Yeah. All right. Well, let's read the next couple of chapters for next week, 5 and 6, and we'll pick up there.